a dead body?
No. Think about building a new temple to Athena, atop the Acropolis. Pericles looked at me curiously.
Why do you care so much, Nikolaos?
It was a good question. There'd been a time when I wondered if Athens deserved my support. I'd even considered abandoning my city. Not that I would admit that to Pericles. Athens is my home, I told him. It's my future. If I'm to have a position of any importance in the world, it's in Athens, Pericles. And I'd rather my city were one of power. Who wants to be a powerful man in a weak city? Best to be powerful in a place of power.
You're ambitious.
Yes. I'd committed myself to Athens. Now I wanted Athens to commit to me. We were not the only ones in awe of the new building. A constant trickle of men wandered in from the direction of the stadium and stopped in the sanctuary where we stood. Every man did the same as us, stared up at the tall columns of stone and the massive roof. The roof was tiled in marble. It must have cost a small fortune every time a tile slipped, but it was worth it. The play of light across the thin, polished marble gave the roof the sheen of a still, deep pond. I like the roof tiles, I said. Can we have tiles like that?
I'll see what I can arrange, Pericles said.
You know, we're wasting our time even talking about it, don't you? I said. Athens can't afford anything like this.
We'll have to see. Certainly the state coffers are low. But, Nikolaos, a decent quality temple to Athena should not be beyond the Athenians.
Who paid for this one? I asked.
The Hellenes, using booty they pillaged long ago during their war against the Pisans.
Then all we need to do is pillage someone, I said lightly.
Yes, I'd come to the same conclusion, Pericles said in all seriousness. I must think about that.
Dear gods, I would have to think about that. Was Pericles serious?
I must leave you, I said. I have an appointment. The entrance to the Temple of Zeus faced east, as most temples do, so that Apollo's first rays of the day can shine within. I avoided the ramp and instead climbed the three large steps. A man stood inside. I didn't notice him at first, because it was much darker within, and it took my eyes time to adjust. When they did, I saw he was a shifty-looking fellow, with a black beard who wore the eczemas of a tradesman. I wondered if he was the one I had come to meet. I stood in the center to give him a chance to approach me, but he didn't move, merely watched me from the side. Looking around the inside, I could see spots where the builders hadn't finished, areas not yet painted, decorations not carved, in the corners and out-of-the-way places. Torches hung in wall brackets, and braziers stood in the corners and along the sides, but none of them were lit.
What do you think?
The man with the black beard asked.
It's amazing. I rubbed my hand along the walls. It looks like marble.
It's not. It only looks that way. You touch stucco, which has been craftily applied to have the look of marble. Beneath, it's limestone.
You seem to know something about it, I observed.
So I should, young man. My name is Leben. I'm the architect.
I realized I had just made a fool of myself.
If it isn't a rude question, Leben, what are you doing lurking in the shadows?
You stand in my life's work, young man. I will do nothing greater. The reaction of the Hellenes to my temple
over the next 3 days will decide whether my life has been worthwhile. If you faced that sort of judgment, what would you do?
I would lurk in the shadows and watch everyone's reaction, I said.
Exactly. To talk to Lieben would be the perfect cover while I waited for my meeting. I had no idea what the man looked like, but he obviously knew me. With Lieben, I could stand in the middle of the temple in perfect innocence, yet make it easy for the informer to spot me. Lieben was as eager as I was.
Let me show you my temple.
He dragged me across to the entrance through which I'd come.
Main entrance, he said, when we were outside on the steps. Look up.
He pointed to the pediment, the triangular area that closed off the end of the roof. In a temple, these are always filled with a sculpture in relief. Though it was dusk and the entrance faced east, there was still sufficient light by which to see, because it was the middle of summer and the moon was already rising bright. The relief sculpture showed two men and their attendants, each man before his chariot. Zeus stood in the center of the scene, from which position he took oaths from the two men, who were obviously about to race.
Is this an Olympic chariot race? I asked.
Older than the Olympics, Lieben said. Or perhaps the first Olympic race, depending on how you look at it. Do you know the story? Do you know who the drivers are?
No.
Lieben pointed to a very ancient ruined building to the north, halfway between the Temple of Zeus, where we stood, and the Temple of Hera.
Do you see the ruined house over there, with only the shattered walls still standing?
That is, or was,
the Megaron, the great house of King Onomaus. He ruled this land long ago, before even the time of Homer.
Then Lieben pointed to the relief at the figure beside the second chariot.
That is King Onomaus there.
I see.
Lieben turned me slightly to the left.
Now, see that mound beside the Megaron.
It was a large burial mound of the kind used by the ancients, enclosed within a wall of five sides.
That is the burial mound of the hero Pelops, the hero king for whom this land is named, the Peloponnesian Peninsula.
Let me guess, the other driver in relief is Pelops?
Correct. According to legend, King Onomaus had a daughter, a girl of great beauty, by the name of Hippodamia. Whoever should marry Hippodamia would inherit the rule of the land. Needless to say, a great many unsuitable men asked for the hand of the beautiful Hippodamia, so many that it became an irritant. Onomaus developed a way of discouraging suitors. He challenged them to a chariot race. If Onomaus won, then he killed the foolish suitor with his bright spear. But if the suitor won, then the suitor would marry the girl and become heir to the kingdom. Many men died in pursuit of beauty and wealth. Then the hero Pelops came along. He asked for the hand of Hippodamia. Onomaus set the usual condition. Luckily for Pelops, Hippodamia fell in love with him. She bribed her father's charioteer, a man by the name of Myrtilus, to remove the linchpins from the wheels of her father's racing chariot. His reward, if he did so, would be half the kingdom,
and the first night in the bed of Hippodamia. And so the race was arranged. The hero and the king swore their oaths before mighty Zeus. It is the scene you see in the pediment. Then the race began. Pelops surged to the lead. It seemed Pelops must win, but the chariot of Onomaus made ground. Onomaus raised his spear to slay Pelops as they raced, when at that moment the wheels of his chariot flew off. Onomaus, caught up in the reins, was dragged to his death. Pelops married Hippodamia, became king at once, and they all lived happily ever after, except for Hippodamia's father, who was somewhat dead. What about the charioteer Myrtilus? He reaped the usual harvest for treachery. Pelops murdered the fellow when he was brazen enough to claim his reward. Myrtilus was buried under the Taraxippus at the east end of the Hippodrome. It's the reason there are so many accidents at that turn. The psyche of Myrtilus remains to terrify the horses. I had looked about us as Leban spoke. He noticed my inattention and broke off. "Am I boring you?" he asked. "I'm sorry, Leban. The fact is, I arranged to meet someone here, and I'm looking for him. But the problem is, I don't know what he looks like."
"Won't that make it harder to find him?"
"You've spotted the nub of my problem. I rather hoped he would find me."
"Ah, I understand. You humor an old boar like me, so that you can be visible in the middle of the temple without at the same time being conspicuous."
"No, it's not like that at all." I trailed off at the look of disbelief on his face and sighed. "All right, it is like that. But I was interested in everything you said, truly." Now I felt guilt that I'd used him. He seemed a nice man.
"Then let us see if we can find your anonymous friend," said Leban, with more grace than I would have shown. "Is there anything you can tell me about this person?"
"Well, he's probably a bit nervous," I said nervously.
"We will begin at this end and work our way through," said Leban.
We re-entered the building past the three large doors, all of them open. The first room was the pronaos.
"I used a standard design for the temple, as you can see, Nikolaos,"
Leban said, ending with my name in a loud voice. He had obviously decided to make my presence very obvious in the hope of attracting my informant. Every man in the room had jumped at the sudden loud voice. Everyone knew Nikolaos was present. The room was full of men but empty of decoration, except for a burning brazier of bronze. This was the room where men, wishing to dedicate something precious, could offer it to Zeus by hanging it on the wall. There was only one such offering so far. At nose height beside me was a cunodesma, the cord an athlete used to hold down his penis while he competed. No doubt, the cunodesma had belonged to one of the winners, and he wished to dedicate it to the god who had granted him the victory.
"Look at the floor," Leban instructed.
The floor had been paved in tiny colored pebbles. The pebbles had been artfully arranged to make a scene: silverfish in a blue sea, white seabirds, and, in the middle, a triton.
"Now, let us move on."
We walked from the pronaos to the naos. The naos was the main room of the temple. Two rows of seven pillars each supported the ceiling, which was high-quality wood, oiled and polished till it gleamed. The naos was divided into four sections.
"The statue of Zeus will go in the third of the four quarters," Leban said. "They haven't begun it yet."
I peered into the darkness of the large room, and I wondered if this was why the mysterious informant had specified dusk. In this light, he could speak to me, and it would be difficult to recognize him later.
"The statue is planned to reach halfway up," said Leban.
I looked up. It was a long, long way to that wooden ceiling.
"Zeus will be sculpted sitting on his throne. If the god stood up, his head would hit the ceiling."
"Let's hope he doesn't, then," I said. "A god with a bad headache is to be avoided." Leban and I had made as much noise as possible and called attention to ourselves. "Are there any more parts to this temple?" I asked.
"There's the opisthodomus, of course," he replied. "It's a room about the size of the pronaos, but on the west side. It has no connection to the inside. It's more like a covered porch with a bench running along the back wall."
"What's it good for?"
"Meeting your friends in bad weather."
Leban led me out the entrance and around the building to the west side. Many men were there to talk and admire the sunset. Leban and I again made a fuss of ourselves, but no one approached, except to ask us to speak more quietly.
"Are you sure this person is coming?" Leban asked. "I'm afraid, Nikolaos, son of Sophroniscus, that you have been stood up."
"I'm afraid, Leban, master architect, that you are right. Could we make one final sweep in the naos? It makes sense that is where he would go."
"Why so?"
"Because it is darkest there and so easiest to hide." As I said it, Apollo dipped below the forest on the other side of the Cladios to begin his journey around the underside of Gaia.
"Not anymore," Leban said.
"What do you mean?"
"When Apollo descends, the slaves light the torches within the temple. The naos will soon be as bright as day."
We hurried back to the other side for the entrance. I grabbed a torch from a passing girl slave. She wanted to protest, but when she saw Leban, she subsided. Men began to leave for whatever parties they had planned for the evening. It made my job easier. I walked all around the edge of the room. There was no one who looked like he might be skulking. I said, "Leban, I notice some flagstones are pulled up where the statue is destined to go."
"The flooring is receiving extra reinforcement to support the weight to come. Those are limestone blocks you see raised."
"Mind if we have a look?"
"Be my guest."
Together, we looked down into the space created where the floor stones had been raised. There, lying in a pool of blood, was the weedy man in the Heracles costume. I heard Leban gag, but that didn't stop him from leaning over for a closer look in the semi-dark.
"There's something odd about him," Leban said, puzzled.
"So there is," I agreed. "He has four eyes." His eyes were wide open. Many people died like that. But the killer had carefully placed an extra eyeball facing upward on each cheek. Combined with the ragged lion skin, he had the look of some strange creature out of myth. He stared at me accusingly, with all four eyes, as if his death was my fault. For all I knew, he might be right. The slave from whom I had snatched the torch took one look and screamed. She had to be led away, sobbing.
What is this?
Lieben exclaimed, and then,
Who is he? Is this your friend?
I think he must be. As to his name, I have no idea, though we met once. I don't suppose you know him.
Not I.
I gave a slave directions to the tent of Diotima and ordered him to bring her. It was rude of me. The slave wasn't mine to command, but Lieben gave no protest. Perhaps it was because of the torchlight, but his skin had noticeably grayed. I'm sorry if the presence of the corpse disturbs you, Lieben, I said. I wouldn't have had it happen after your kindness. Lieben's voice was harsh when he said,
I manage a building site, young man. I've seen dead men aplenty in accidents.
This was no accident.
No, and that's what disturbs me.
A disturbance at the entrance. Heads turned. Diotima ran in, followed by a panting Pindar.
I saw this young lady of yours race across the sanctuary, and I knew something of importance must have occurred,
he explained between gasps.
I'm getting too old for this sort of thing. What's happening?
I told them both of the note and the meeting.
I suppose you've let the informant get killed. Diotima got straight to the point.
Thanks very much for your confidence.
Is it the informant?
Well, yes, I had to concede. But I didn't let him die. He got himself killed without my permission. Remember the weedy-looking fellow who accosted us at the Agora? It's him, Diotima. She looked down at the corpse. She turned pale.
The eyes, she said.
Yes. We looked at each other, no need to say a word. The eyes of Arikos had been removed. Here they were.
Notice anything else strange? Diotima asked.
I looked carefully, but saw nothing beyond.
He's dead?
I suggested. Diotima glared.
Thank you, Asclepius. Where's his club?
Club?
He swung a club at us.
Maybe he didn't bring it.
A pity. He could have defended himself.
The blood had poured from a gash in his throat.
We'll never know what he had to say, Diotima said. And the Temple of Zeus is polluted, right in the middle of the sacred games. Have you any idea the damage it does when someone dies in a temple? They'll be up all night ritually cleansing the place. What a mess. Well done, Nico, she accused me.
Me? I didn't do anything.
Why must you always get there after the witness has been killed?
Pindar had listened to our argument with something like a half-smile. Now he asked,
Has this sort of thing happened before?
All too often,
Diotima grated.
Pindar said, Perhaps if in the future Nico could arrive at secret meetings early.
Marcos ran in. He was hot and sweaty.
I just heard.
He looked down at the corpse.
Unfortunate. Who is he?
Diotima said.
You knew about this meeting?
Yes.
Then each of you is as bad as the other. Why weren't you here, Marcos?
My presence probably would have scared him off,
I added. The note specifically said only me.
I don't suppose it occurred to either of you that Marcos could have covered the outside of the building. You might even...
She glared at me.
Have considered telling me. I could have visited the Temple of Hera, which is right next door to the Temple of Zeus. Between Marcos and me, we could have observed everyone who went in and out, and we could have been in place long before the meeting time.
We could have spotted any man going in who looked nervous. We could have noted anyone who followed another man. As it is, anyone could have walked in and out of the building without Nico seeing him.
A long silence followed. Marcos broke it with the words,
I think we've been told off, my friend.
Diotima's right, I said.
She is indeed. I'll never conduct an investigation without her approval again. You're lucky to have her.
It was the worst thing he could have said, because Diotima wasn't mine. We both froze. Marcos looked from one to the other of us, then he remembered.
Oops, he said. Nico told me, but I forgot. I apologize.
You told Marcos about the dowry problems?
Diotima said. I could hear her anger.
Yes.
How could you?
Let's concentrate on who could have killed the fake Heracles, I said hastily to change the subject.
Who knew he'd be here? You and Marcos, but not me,
Diotima said pointedly.
Does anyone know who he is, other than a fake Heracles, I mean?
Silence.
Perhaps we should wait to see who reports a missing man,
Diotima said.
Marcos and I both stared at her in surprise.
In Olympia?
I said.
That's like waiting for one particular drunk in a dockside inn.
Men wander between the camps all the time, Marcos added. You could go missing and no one would notice until the games were over.
I'll wager that happens, I said.
Marcos nodded.
It does. At the end of every games there are always a few tents still standing, when all the others have been pulled down. That's when men look at each other and say, Where's Ariston, or Where's Lysanias, or whatever the fool's name is. So they search for Ariston or Lysanias, and they find him dead drunk in a ditch. Or they find he fell into the river when he was dead drunk, and now he's just dead.
You sound like you speak from experience,
Diotima said gently.
I do. I was assigned to the security detail in the Spartan camp at the last games. One of the missing men was my own father. We found him floating under the weeds by the bank.
I'm sorry, Marcos,
Diotima said.
Marcos shrugged.
There's nothing anyone can do about it now.
I said,
No.
And there's nothing we can do about this murder either. Probably our best witness just died.
Day 4 of the 80th Olympiad of the Sacred Games. News of the second murder spread like plague. The temple slaves took great delight in telling anyone who'd listen that the corpse had been discovered with four eyes. The gory detail was enough to make men shudder. Men began to say that the games were cursed. The body had been found in the brand new Temple of Zeus. Surely there could be no stronger confirmation that Zeus had deserted us. I had to admit, when you put it all together, it didn't look good. First, the murder of Arachos, a cursed event, if ever there was one. The games are first and foremost sacred to the gods. Then the affair of the Ox of Do. At any other Olympics, it would have been laughed off. Now it was another item on the list of sacrilegious disasters. Empedocles had to quietly leave Olympia that night, for his own safety. I thanked the gods no one had recognized me. The crowd had been too busy watching the more interesting philosopher. As to why Zeus had abandoned us, men didn't look far for a reason. Too many at Olympia had also been at Nemea. The Pancratists, Pindar,
probably the heralds, no doubt others. People began to talk. By the time the moon had reached its peak, every man at Olympia had heard the ugly rumor, as One Eye had called it, that Timodemus, the man accused of murdering Arikos, had somehow cheated at the Nemean Games. Clearly, Timodemus had cursed the sacred games. The guards, who had been set to keep Timodemus in, now found themselves keeping a lynch mob out. Spartans, Scarathos vocal among them, claimed that Athens was to blame. The Athenians were as vocal in claiming a conspiracy against them. The men of other cities supported one side or the other, as their alliances or inclinations led them. What had been a predominantly Sparta-Athens dispute now consumed every man present. Overnight, Olympia deteriorated into islands of armed camps. Men moved carts, packing boxes, and supplies, anything they could find, to create low walls around the tents of each city. With so many blacksmiths and weapon makers present, it was a simple matter to turn tent poles into serviceable spears. Despite the sacred truce, a few forbidden swords appeared as if from nowhere. Where a man might the day before have walked between camps unhindered, now guards protected each entrance. They stopped and questioned every visitor and passed through only the men of allied cities. A strange thing had happened.
"Olympia has turned into a microcosm of Hellas," Pericles said to me within the privacy of his own tent next morning, the dawn of day 4. He was bleary-eyed. Pericles had spent the night consulting with the leaders of the other cities and doing what he could to keep men calm, despite which he was oddly exhilarated. Sport might have bored Pericles senseless, but he lived for politics.
"Is that bad?"
"It's fascinating. I'm beginning to think there might be a point to the Olympics after all. Do you realize, Nico, what we're seeing here is how each city would react if it came to general war between the Hellenes? What happens here will inform our foreign policy for years to come."
"And what is happening?"
"The cities of the Aegean Islands are supporting us, for the most part. It's in their best interests. They're closest to Persia. They need a strong Athens to protect them. The cities of the Peloponnese are supporting Sparta. No surprise there. If they didn't, they could expect a Spartan army at their gates. All except Argos."
"The men of Argos don't fear Sparta?"
"The men of Argos have hated Sparta since time immemorial."
"Oh, what of the cities to the north?"
"The opportunists from Thebes are negotiating with both sides. Delphi is staying out of it."
"Is anyone playing any sport through all this?"
"Apparently, but I'm not paying any attention. We must consider the alignment of forces if a fight breaks out."
"At Olympia? With the sacred truce?"
"I know, but Nico, the way things are going, it could come to blows between Athens and Sparta. If it does, every other city will be drawn into it. We should be thankful the sacred truce forbids bringing arms into the district. If it does, turn into a fight. And I wouldn't put it past the Corinthians to egg everyone on, then the lack of weapons will limit the deaths."
I had a sudden thought. Do the Spartans have any better idea than us on how to control this?
No. Worse, if anything. Spartans make excellent bullies, but terrible diplomats.
Then no one knows what will happen if it comes to blows.
I sincerely hope no one wants to find out. But we must prepare, Nikolaos. We must prepare for the worst.
What should we do?
There's only one thing you should do.
He glared at me.
Find the answer to who killed Arachos, and it had better be the right answer. Without that, I can guarantee a war inside Olympia.
Despite all our theories, we were no closer to proving a killer. There was only one thing left that I could try. Lieben's guided tour of the temple had inspired me. I wasn't sure it was a good idea, but I'd discussed it with Diotima anyway, late last night, after everyone else had left the temple and before she'd returned to her tent in the women's camp. I always talked things through with her. I wondered how I'd cope when she was some other man's wife. Diotima and I had both agreed my idea was unlikely, but with so little time, any hope was better than none. I took Socrates with me to the sanctuary of Zeus, where Nilos continued his mission to drink himself into oblivion. Luckily for me, it was early morning. Nilos had had most of the night to sleep off the previous day's effort. Even so, the smell was horrendous. I slapped him around until he came to. Nilos peered at me with eyes that were red from excessive drink and copious tears, and he mumbled,
"You again? Go away. Every time you turn up, it's bad luck for someone else."
That was so true, I didn't bother arguing. Instead, I said,
"Maybe not this time. Listen, Nilos, do you want to do something for Iphicles?"
"There isn't anything anyone can do for Iphicles."
"Yes, there is. But only you can do it."
"What? Why me?"
"Because you know better than anyone all the parts that make up a chariot. You'd recognize even the tiniest piece, wouldn't you?"
"Sure."
"I want you to go with this boy. His name's Socrates. He talks a lot, but try to ignore that. And I want you to search the hippodrome for pieces from Iphicles' chariot." Nilos looked at me as if I were mad. I told him what to search for and why. It was the first Socrates had heard of my idea. When I finished, Socrates looked at me in admiration and said,
"Nico, that's brilliant!"
Nilos rubbed his chin and sat up straighter.
"I see. If this were true..."
"I don't know, Nilos, but do this for me, will you? Socrates will help."
Nilos dusted off his clothing. He looked human again already.
"If you're right, we can do this quickly."
I was torn over what to do about Diotima. With the fighting that was about to break out, would she be safer in the women's camp or in the middle of the Athenians? I went to see her. Pythax was with her in her tent. He was black and blue from the beating Dromaeus had delivered. There was a lump over one eye, and his hair was still matted with traces of blood. But I was relieved to see him. If it came to a battle, Pythax would see Diotima safe.
"You're not needed,"
Pythax growled. Technically, he was right. Diotima was no longer my responsibility, but that wouldn't stop me protecting her.
"What's your plan, Pythax?"
"Diotima's safe enough," said Pythax. "She's got a Spartan admirer."
"What's this?"
I noticed Diotima's eyes were red. Had she been crying?
"I told you I got to do my best for my girl."
"Yes."
"I got an offer."
Already?
"Surprised me, too. I hadn't even asked around yet, not with all the troubles. But he said he knew Diotima had become free. It's a good offer. He's a Spartan, good family, got a high position, and he don't want much in dowry."
"What position?"
"Says he's a knight. That's high up."
Dear gods. My heart raced.
His name is Marcos.
He'd asked me if Diotima had a sister, and I'd told him he'd have to find his own beautiful and clever priestess. It seemed he had. Marcos had betrayed me.
This Marcos, what's he like?
Pythax asked. I wanted to say he was evil. I wanted to say he was poor and a coward, and he beat women. But Pythax had to do his best for Diotima, and I had to help him, because I wanted the best for her, too. I thought about my answer for a long time, before I came to a reluctant conclusion. I admire him, I said. But Pythax... The tent flap flew open at that moment, and Socrates ran in, followed by Nilos, who was both excited and sober.
Nico, Nico, look what we've got!
Socrates skidded to a halt in front of me and held up a tiny piece of metal, as if he'd discovered the world's greatest treasure.
What is it?
I stared at the bent bronze. It was a thick piece of wire.
It's the linchpin from a chariot,
said Nilos.
From our chariot. You were right, Nikolaos. It's just like the story of Pelops and Enemaeus.
Where did you find it?
On the floor of the team box, said Socrates. Nilos showed me where to search.
Diotima and I stared at each other.
Then that solves it, she said. But I can barely believe it. Who would have thought?
Not me, I said. It's almost impossible to prove. I thought about it.
We'll have to trick everyone. And I know how to do it. Listen to this.
Diotima spoke for a long time. I wasn't happy with her idea, but I knew she was right. Pythax growled.
I'll see to my end of it.
I nodded, reluctantly. Diotima put an arm around me.
I'm sorry, Nico. This'll be so painful for your friend.
It was the afternoon of day 4. At any moment, the wrestling would begin. Then it would be the boxing, and finally, the pancration. I went to see Timodemus in his prison. The walls were scarred where an angry mob had attacked because they believed Timodemus was the cause of all their troubles. At one place, there was actually a hole smashed all the way through, where someone with a pickaxe had repeatedly struck the weakened, ancient stones. It occurred to me that Timodemus was lucky to be alive. I thanked the guards as I passed, though. One of them spat.
Don't thank me. If it weren't for the priestess of the games, I would have handed over the little bastard.
I blinked. Climene was here?
She stood where you are now, folded her arms, and dared the mob to pass her. She said they'd only get to Timodemus over her dead body.
Well, wasn't that interesting? Timodemus paced in his room. It was obvious he'd been at it some time.
I'm not used to the lack of exercise, he explained. I need to keep moving.
Not much room, I said. Timo shrugged.
I've been doing jumps and push-ups. It's enough. The forced rest may even have done me some good.
He smiled wryly.
Do you think it's important for a man who's about to be executed to be healthy?
Timo did indeed look better than he had in a long time. He'd always worn training scrapes and cuts and bruises. 3 days with no practice had given them time to heal.
Why do you fight, Timo?
I asked. He smiled.
It would hurt if I just stood there and let them hit me.
No, this is a serious question. Why do you walk into the ring time after time? Timo stood for a long while, contemplating. Then he scratched his balls.
I don't know,
he said. That's the sum total of your deep personal introspection?
I asked.
Listen, Nico, have you ever known a time when I didn't fight?
No.
There you are, then. Fighting is what I do. If I stopped, I wouldn't be Timo anymore.
You fight because your father told you to fight, I said.
Well, yes,
he admitted reluctantly.
But that was when I was a child. So long ago it doesn't matter anymore.
Do you want to go on?
Why are you asking me this?
Your father demands I move your trial forward, to before the Pancration.
So I can compete?
If you survive the trial, yes. And listen, I think I know what happened. But trials are tricky things, my friend. The result might not turn out the way you'd want.
Then it's like the Pancration. No matter how good you are, you can never be sure how it'll end.
There's something else of which I must warn you, Timo. After this trial is over, even if the judges acquit you, you might not feel like competing.
I see.
He sat there and said nothing. I wondered if he truly did see.
Timo, what do you want me to do? If you want to fight, the trial has to be right now.
Timo thought for a moment.
The choice is mine?
Entirely yours. If you say you want to wait till tomorrow, then that's what we do. I'll tell your father it was my decision. When I will never know it's what you wanted.
Now Timo really did think, staring at the floor. I sat as quiet as I could to not disturb him while he considered his fate. Timo looked up and said,
"Let's go for it."
Pindar, I've got a job for you.
What? Another commission?
You want to do this one for free.
I explained what I needed and why. Pindar laughed.
You're right, my young friend. I'll do this purely to see the looks on their faces.
That's good, because I couldn't afford you twice. Speaking of which, how's my praise song coming along?
At the moment, I actively seek inspiration and explore the exciting possibilities, all within the efficient confines of my febrile imagination.
What does that mean?
It means I haven't done a thing. But don't worry, I always do my best work in a rush, right before the deadline.
So do I. I hope.
As I walked through the Athenian camp, I came across Festianos outside his tent.
Have you heard the news? I said to him.
No, what?
The judges have agreed to try Timodemus this afternoon.
A day early?
I told Exelon I have enough evidence to clear Timo's name. Marcos says he's ready to prosecute. They agreed to bring it forward. If he's found innocent, and with my evidence I'm feeling confident, they'll allow him to compete.
I don't know why you look so surprised, Festianos. This is exactly what your brother One-Eye demanded.
Yes, it is. But I never thought the judges would agree. I'm not... That is, we're not ready. Timo hasn't trained at all these last days.
I shrugged. There's nothing I can do about that, I'm afraid. Will I see you at the trial?
Yes, of course.
I continued on my way down the path and out the camp entrance. As I rounded the corner, I passed Pindar and Socrates.
Don't lose him,
I said out of the corner of my mouth. Everything was set in motion, and there was no way to recall it. Timodemus would live or die according to whether our plan worked. The trial of Timodemus was held in the central room of the Bouletarian. To arrange the matter at such short notice,
With the presence of the judges required at every event, the trial had to be held between the boxing and the pancration. I waited inside for the judges and the witnesses to arrive. Marcos waited with me. I barely knew what to say to the man who'd offered to marry Diotima. I settled for,
"You asshole! I thought you were my friend!"
I resisted the urge to punch him down.
"But it's over between the two of you," Marcos said. "You told me so yourself. That's why I thought I was free to say something."
"That doesn't mean I like it. Couldn't you at least have had the decency to wait until the games were over?"
"I didn't want to risk another man offering first. Would you risk losing a prize like her?"
"No,"
I said bitterly. Marcos put his hand on my shoulder. "I'm sorry, Nico. That was insensitive of me. If I'd thought you were still in with a chance, I wouldn't have said a thing. I'll go to her father after the trial to withdraw my offer."
"Don't bother." I shook my head. "I can't blame you for doing what I want to do myself. Forget it, Marcos. We both have the trial to think about."
"The trial, yes."
Marcos hesitated for a moment, then said,
"Nico, I've come to love you as a friend, but I'm sorry. Once we go to trial, it will be a fight between you and me. I warn you, I'll hold nothing back."
"It's like the pancration," I said, echoing Timodemus.
"Exactly," Marcos agreed.
"It's all right, Marcos," I grinned. "I won't think the less of you when you lose."
"What makes you think I'll lose, Athenian?"
He grinned back, the moment of anger between us gone.
"It'll be me who takes the first ever winner's crown for investigation. 20 drachmae says it'll be me. 50.
Done." The 10 judges filed in. They'd come straight from the stadium. They were covered in sticky sweat to which a layer of dust had adhered. Their hair was plastered down. Behind them came Pericles, King Pleistarchus and his mother, Queen Gorgo, who stepped slowly, Xenares One-Eye, and Festianos, followed by Pindar, and, in the middle, surrounded by guards, Timodemus. The judges sat behind a long bench table. At once, slaves placed cups of watered wine in their hands. As one, they downed the drink and held out their cups for more. If the red skin on their faces and necks was any indication, being under the sun for 4 days had given them all severe sunburn. Exelon opened the proceedings.
"I have a pounding headache. Can we make this quick?"
"Quick, to consider a man's life?"
"The situation is unusual,"
Exelon continued with the understatement of the games.
"But we will proceed along normal lines."
Exelon nodded at Marcos.
"We begin with the prosecution case against Timodemus."
Marcos stepped forward and said suavely,
"I'll be brief."
10 judges nodded in appreciation. Under my breath, I cursed his self-assurance. Why couldn't I be like that?
"Gentlemen, we can twist and turn all we like," began Marcos. "We can consider one hypothesis or another. We can list suspects. We can check their alibis. We can consider motive until the gods themselves go gray of advanced age. We can do all these things, but we can't escape one fact.
who could beat to death the second best unarmed fighter in Hellas, other than the very best? That, gentlemen, is the heart of the issue. I need hardly mention that everyone saw Timodemus attack Arachos on the morning of the murder.
Marco spoke with such authority, his words measured and reasoned, that I found myself unconsciously nodding in agreement. When I realized what I was doing, I stopped. But I knew what effect his words must be having on the others.
And the motive for this killing?
Zanares the Effer asked.
Timodemus cheated at the Nemean Games. Arachos knew it, and intended to expose him.
Exclamations from the judges, though I knew at least half of them, must have heard the rumors.
And the method of cheating?
Zanares prompted. The two must have prearranged this dialogue.
Witchcraft,
Marcos said, gasps and murmurs of shock.
Is this true?
One judge demanded.
I believe so, sir, said Marcos. Arachos, who had been at Nemea and lost to Timodemus in the last round, stood ready to expose what had happened there. Of course such news would disqualify the accused for the Olympics. These are lies!
Timo shouted.
The rumors about Nemea are rife,
Marco said calmly.
You can check them for yourselves.
Several men nodded. It seemed they already had.
The final evidence is this.
Marcos tossed onto the bench the ostracon he'd found in the tent of Arachos. It clattered across the wooden top, loud in the sudden silence of the room. A judge picked up the broken pottery to read the message I'd seen 2 days ago.
Timodemus says this to Arachos. I offer to meet you in the woods across the river tonight. The implication is clear, said Marcos. Timodemus lured Arachos to the woods with this message. Timodemus struck Arachos on the forehead without warning. You've all seen the body. Then beat him to death.
Marcos stepped back.
A brilliant summary, Marcos. Short, succinct, conclusive, said Zanares. What says Athens?
Exelon demanded. I can explain this, sirs, I said. But, it might take a little while. 10 judges frowned. I licked my lips and tasted salty sweat. I hadn't realized until that moment how hot and close was the room. I plowed on. Timodemus stands accused of cheating through witchcraft, a charge for which there's no defense. It's all but impossible to prove innocence in such cases. I paused. I call upon Festianos, the uncle of Timodemus, to give evidence.
What's this?
Festianos stepped to the center. He looked worried.
Only that you were at Nemea, Festianos. As were hundreds of men. Most of them are at Olympia.
I ignored Festianos and said to Exelon, Sir, I'll need some other evidence. I call for Diotima, a lady of Athens.
You're bringing in a woman?
Exelon said. Two women, actually, sir. The other one's a pornay. I also have a doctor. Oh, and my little brother. Before Exelon could object, I opened the door, where stood waiting Diotima and Petali, and behind them Socrates and Heraclides. Diotima walked in and placed on the table before the judges a large canvas bag. It rattled and clattered. She untied it
and pulled out the case of vials. "Festianos, can you tell me what this is?" I said. Diotima opened the case for all to see the vial.